Welcome to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. A new week and new drama for the Michigan State University Board of Trustees. This week, the board welcomed three new members, but complaints about shutting down the Healing Assistance Fund for survivors of Larry Nassar's abuse persist. WKAR government and politics reporter Abigail Sinsky attended this week's trustees meeting and joins me now. Welcome, Abigail.
Thank you.
First, I want to talk about the Healing Fund for survivors of Larry Nassar's abuse. The trustees established a new fund, I understand.
Right. That was probably the biggest surprise of the meeting. It wasn't on the agenda going into the meeting, and they had closed the original fund for survivors of Larry Nassar's abuse, and it was originally $10 million. They closed that back in December when they made a payment of $500 million to a larger settlement fund. They said the remaining $8.5 million in the fund would then go towards that $500 million settlement to reduce the amount of money the school basically would have to pay. But when they closed it, there was a lot of backlash, and there was actually an online petition created, which over 1,600 people have signed, including many notable figures like former Governor Jennifer Granholm, Governor Gretchen Whitmer. So they made the motion to establish a new fund, which people seem to be a little trepidatious about. They seem to be happy with the decision. The board did vote unanimously to establish a new fund. Trustee Brian Masalam was actually one of the trustees who opposed the closing of the original fund, and he said he was happy there would effectively be a new fund, but he did lose his bid for chair, which he viewed kind of as another emblem of the transformative reform that he hopes to see on the board.
Really happy that we were unanimous on this Healing Assistance Fund. I think it's critical that we move forward with it. And, and I'm also going to say something that probably hasn't been said much in public. You know, I really want to thank Dan Kelly. I appreciated his support, and, you know, Dan Kelly breaking the 4-4 tie because of the ramifications is leadership, quite frankly.
Yeah, so what Masalam is talking about there is Diane Byram was elected chair and Dan Kelly was elected vice chair, and they could have been deadlocked in their vote for chair and vice chair. So if Dan Kelly hadn't voted for Diane Byram and broke the potential deadlock, then the past vice chair, Joel Ferguson, could have been elected chair of the board for a 2-year term, which I think many of the survivors would have been unhappy about.
Back to the Healing Fund. Is there a timetable for it to start?
So we talked to Diane Byram after the meeting, and she said there weren't official numbers attached to the fund yet. She said those would likely be available in February, but this is what she said about that.
The details are still to be worked out, and it would be premature for me to even suggest what those details are, because that needs to be a collective conversation. That's not just my conversation. And so the details have not been worked out. Everything's on the table right now.
Obviously, we're hoping to get more information about that. One of the survivor advocacy groups, Reclaim MSU, actually issued a statement after the meeting saying, "We're reserving judgment on the fund until we know more. Who will it cover? When will it open? And for how long? Will it be restored to the full $8.5 million? The fund should be open as soon as possible, no later than February 1st. It should be available to all Nassar survivors and their families, not just those who were abused at MSU." And their statement continued, but those were basically some of their demands. And they raise a lot of good questions there. Who will be covered by this fund? How long will it go on? One of the chief complaints of many of the critics when the original fund was closed was Trustee Breslin at that point said that, you know, this really was never supposed to be an ongoing thing. This was supposed to be a bridge for people who were in the settlement to pay for their counseling and mental health services before they received settlement money. However, you know, the other side of that, the flip side was, okay, not everybody is in the settlement. So the fund kind of allows more people to be covered under that umbrella who may not be party to the original settlement.
So Abigail, what was the reaction from survivors?
So there wasn't a lot of reaction in the meeting. It was actually quieter than previous meetings with no audible chants or backlash, but there was a lot of backlash on Twitter. People seemed to be upset, particularly that Diane Byram was elected chair because she had to receive the votes of trustees Ferguson, Foster to be elected chair, which the survivors are a little dubious of those board members. And then people were also mad at the new trustee, Brianna Scott, who voted in that block to elect Diane Byram as chair. Actually, Rachel Denhollander, the first woman to publicly come forward and accuse Nassar, tweeted, "Trustee Ferguson has been a huge part of the problem at MSU and attacked survivors with lies multiple times, refusing all efforts to change. Diane Byram had to rely on Ferguson and Melanie Foster to get elected, and that tells us everything we need to know about the new chair." And Brianna Scott actually replied to that on Twitter saying, "Rachel, you are misinformed. Perhaps you can call me if you'd like to know the truth. There was no ticket. There was no slate. In fact, I stated I would have voted for Nancy. However, Snyder's appointment letter specified he appointed her as a Democrat." And that's also a key part of the parliamentary imbroglio of how this vote took place, because the chair and vice chair have to be from differing parties. And Nancy Schlichting, who is one of the newest trustees and also kind of branded herself as reformed-minded and interested in really advocating for survivors in her position on the board, she was unavailable to be elected chair or vice chair on that ticket because in Governor Snyder's appointment letter, he specified he was filling the place of Democrat George Perlis. So her role, even though she didn't run in any official party platform capacity, would be considered a Democratic space on the board.
We are talking with WKAR government and politics reporter Abigail Sinsky about new moves taken by the MSU Board of Trustees. And as you were mentioning, this is the first meeting for Nancy Schlichting, appointed by Governor Rick Snyder, the former governor, to fill George Perlis' spot. You talked with her earlier this week. What do we know about her?
Nancy Schlichting was appointed by former Governor Snyder, and she said she's coming into this with a heavy heart for the survivors and really wants to advocate for them. And she'd like to see the board play a much larger oversight role and have much more outward-facing responsibility for the actions and the tone that is set by the university. This is an outline of some of the things that she hoped would happen in her term on the board.
I don't think major decisions such as the healing fund should happen without board consultation. I think the board needs to make sure that we have, you know, strong structures in place, process in place around compliance, around creating a safe environment for people to speak up. I think clearly selecting a new president who embraces the challenge that Michigan State is dealing with, who is a healer for the university.
One of her main priorities was getting the fund reinstated or establishing a new fund, which happened at the first meeting. And also, she believes one of the biggest things that the board can do in the coming years to, you know, change the tone and the culture at the university will be selecting a new president.
Well, and we could find out who the new president is maybe around June, possibly. That was WKAR government and politics reporter Abigail Sinsky reporting on the MSU trustees. Thank you for stopping in and talking about this important week.
Happy to do it.
Later this month, we expect former MSU President Luana K. Simon to appear in an Eaton County courtroom. State police said she lied to investigators about the Nassar investigation in May. She is charged with two felonies and two misdemeanors. Her lawyer says the charges have no merit. The idea of Luana K. Simon, who rose from professor to provost to president, now facing a possible trial for damaging the campus she wants to help build, continues to shake MSU to its core. It's the subject of an article by Jack Stripling, senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education. He joins us via Skype right now. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Reginald. Thanks for having me.
What was your goal in writing this article?
Well, I think like a lot of people, I was just really struck by this image of Lou Anna Simon, you know, who'd been this longstanding figure within higher education, within the NCAA, and of course with Michigan State University, sitting behind a defendant's table, looking gaunt, looking upset, looking kind of angry. And it was such a jarring image for me. And I couldn't imagine what that must have looked like to people who'd known her a long time. So I wanted to see if we could reach out to people who'd had a history with her and get an impression of what's going through their heads. What are they thinking as they see this real transformation sort of happening, where it's somebody who had been respected and reputable at the institution is now really going through the gears of the justice system.
You talked to a few faculty members that say they have some conflicting feelings when they saw the picture of Lou Anna Simon in the courtroom last year.
Yeah, I did. And I should mention that, you know, I talked to a lot more people than you'll hear in the story. And I think that that tells you something in and of itself. People are very concerned that anything that expressed any kind of sympathy or support for Dr. Simon might be perceived by survivors as invalidating their own very real and reasonable anger at her and her administration, who they think are responsible for not reining in Larry Nassar more quickly. But those who would talk to me, and I was impressed that some of them were quite reflective, talked about feeling ambivalent, talked about their inability to look at somebody who they've known as a human being, who they've known as a top administrator, who now, you know, really faces the real possibility of going to prison. I don't think we should understate this. I mean, these two felonies are both punishable by up to 4 years in prison, and this could string on for a long time, but this is very serious.
We were talking with Jack Stripling, senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education. I want to read a line that you wrote. As Simon winds her way through the justice system, more is at risk than her own fate. For Michigan State, bonds of trust and community are under threat. An institution that for generations has been a beacon of pride now presents a more complex story, forcing professors and alumni to reckon with the notion that their beloved university, like Simon herself, may have failed in its most sacred duty to protect young people. How do you see the lack of trust manifest on the MSU campus?
What struck me in talking to people and thinking about this was, you know, normally we are used to seeing a tragedy on a college campus that's a mass shooting, a student dies in an accident, an alcohol-related accident, a hazing death, something like that. Those tend to be situations where communities come together. We're used to seeing the candlelight vigil. We're used to, signs of unity. This is so categorically different because this is about institutional betrayal. And Lou Anna Simon is the image of institutional betrayal. She's this personification of it in the eyes of these survivors. And that is a completely different category of disaster because it doesn't bring the campus together. It tears it apart, and it's continuing to happen. It's hard to watch.
We've been talking with Jack Stripling, senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education, who wrote an article about the complex feelings many are feeling on the MSU campus. And we are, of course, linking that article to WKAR.org. Jack, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. After a year in development, the Flint Registry goes fully live this month. The program aims to connect people exposed to lead-tainted water in the city with programs to help manage their health. The Flint Registry is led by Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, one of the key figures in exposing the Flint water crisis. WKAR's Corel Vega spoke with Dr. Hannah Atisha to learn more about the registry and how it will aim to help the people of Flint. She started by explaining how the registry works.
So the Flint Registry is a voluntary registry. It open to anybody who was exposed to the crisis. So if you lived in Flint, worked in Flint, went to school, daycare in Flint, you can sign up for the registry. Once you sign up for the registry, you'll answer lots of different questions to see how you are doing. And then really the goal of the registry is to get you connected to the resources to mitigate the impact of this crisis and improve health and development. So there's a lot of registries out there, and we've been talking to folks all over the country, especially the World Trade Center registry. And a lot of these registries were built to just really track folks and follow them long term after a crisis. But our registry is a little different. The goal of our registry is to improve outcomes of the people that were exposed to this crisis by connecting them with things like Medicaid and the Lead Safe Home Program and early childhood resources. All the wonderful things that we've been able to bring into the city, we want people to take advantage of. And that's really what this registry is all about.
What was your main motivation for leading the initiative?
Yeah, so the registry was one of our initial asks. We wanted to launch a registry, build a registry from really the recognition of this crisis. We knew that we need a way to identify those who were exposed to the crisis and most importantly to support them long term. So really in late 2015, shortly after that press conference, when we realized we had this population-wide crisis, the registry was on our list of asks in terms of what we were going to do next. We started building this registry locally with no resources. And finally, in December of 2016, in the Flint bill that passed Congress, the funding for the registry was included.
One of the stipulations in the registry is that it's for people exposed to Flint water from 2014 to 2015. Why that span?
Yeah, so the registry is a grant from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and they stipulated the time period of exposure. And that time period is the time that we were on Flint water. And that was from April of 2014 to October of 2015. And we know that that's not when the crisis ended. That's not when lead exposure ended. People didn't even really know that there was lead in water during the 18 months. But that is the folks had to have been exposed to the water during that 18 months when we were on the Flint River, when it was untreated, when we know that there was that lead in the water.
You're listening to Current State. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, leader of the Flint Registry, about the program going fully live this month. Say someone thinks they may be exposed, but they're not sure. How do they go about finding out?
Yeah, so we're not asking for proof of exposure. You don't have to submit any kind of lead level or water lead level. The only eligibility is that you lived in Flint, worked in Flint, went to school in Flint, and then you were essentially exposed and you consumed this water, and you will be eligible, you know, for all the resources that we may be able to connect you to. So there's no necessity to prove that you had consequences. The whole goal of this registry is to find out how you're doing and to really prevent any consequences. One really exciting part of this registry that is a new development is the ability for us to refer to a brand new center called the Neurodevelopmental Center of Excellence. The registry is open for children and for adults. It's for anybody that was exposed to this water crisis. We see a maximum number of people eligible, about 130,000 people who could be part of this registry. But children, we know, had higher risk because of this crisis. Lead disproportionately impacts children. And early adversity, we know, also, you know, adversely affects the life course of a child. So for children, we now have this amazing resource that the registry will be referring children and families to, and that's this new Neurodevelopmental Center of Excellence, which was created by a settlement from the ACLU, as well as some federal Healthy Start dollars, which will enable every Flint child who enrolls in a registry the opportunity to get more thorough neurodevelopmental assessment to see how they're doing. And the goal of this is to connect families to the assessment services and then hopefully the treatment services so that their outcomes can be maximized both in the school setting and in the healthcare setting.
On that note, what is the prognosis for kids who have been exposed to lead in the city's water?
That's exactly what this registry is trying to answer. So I think every day people ask me, how's Flint doing? How are the kids of Flint doing? And I can tell you about how the kids I saw in the clinic are doing this morning. But we need a tool, a data-driven population level tool to answer that question. And that's exactly what the registry hopes to accomplish. The more people that are signed up for the registry, the more powerful this tool will be to answer that question, to answer how is the health of Flint residents? How are the children doing? And once that is up and live and there's a lot of people who are enrolled in it, we'll be able to more objectively answer that question. And once we have those answers, then that will drive our planning and our advocacy in terms of, you know, the resources that we may need to bring in because of the issues that we identify.
As you said, this program's not mandatory, but have you had any trouble with people who maybe lost their trust in any sort of program enrolling in anything after the crisis happened?
Of course. The story of Flint is a story of loss of trust. The people of Flint rightfully have lost trust in any institution that is guarded to protect their health and safety because they were betrayed by every institution that was charged to protect them. So the building of trust is a big part of our work. And that's why the registry from the onset has been community informed, community participatory, and community driven. And about a year ago, we launched pre-enrollment of the registry, where about 6,000 people have pre-enrolled. And that process of pre-enrollment allowed people to provide feedback and input, so their voice was at the table. We've also had many, many focus groups. We have a very active community advisory board meeting. We have parents who are part of this process, and even children who are telling us what they want included in the registry. So this registry was made in Flint, you know, by Flint residents. It is physically based in Flint. We've built a Flint workforce, and all of that is to bolster the trust of the community in this registry, which is theirs.
What are your thoughts on Governor Gretchen Whitmer's recently signed executive directive that requires state employees to immediately report to their bosses any threat to public health or safety?
I think that's a fantastic move. I think that was her first executive order that she did sign. And it's a bold statement to make sure that we do not have any future Flints. State employees should feel comfortable raising any concerns to any level of hierarchy. So often people ask me, why weren't there more whistleblowers within state government? Why weren't there more people raising concerns? And I think this directive will allow individuals the opportunity without fear of retaliation or intimidation to raise future concerns. And I think that was a bold and very smart move.
We've been speaking with Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, director of the MSU Hurley Children's Hospital Pediatric Public Health Initiative, about the Flint Registry going fully live this month. The program will connect people exposed to lead-tainted water with programs to manage their health. Dr. Hanna-Attisha, thank you for speaking with us.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Karel Vega.
Just ahead, a chat with Michigan's new Secretary of State. 400-plus bills passed in last month's lame duck session. From politicians to protesters, we'll compare it to earlier lame ducks. Plus, a place to see a nationally televised program shot right here in the Capital Region. Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region, continues right after this. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. We are turning now to Michigan politics and government. Jocelyn Benson is Michigan's first Democratic Secretary of State in more than 20 years. She took her oath of office January 1st and is coming into the office at a time when elections and voting in Michigan will see major updates. WKAR's Abigail Sinsky has more.
Jocelyn Benson was elected alongside Propositions 2 and 3 in the 2018 midterms. The proposals included changes to redistricting, early and absentee voting, voter registration, and election audits. She begins her term after several bills attempting to modify Propositions 2 and 3 and remove her office's oversight of campaign finance died during December's lame duck session. In her inaugural remarks, she called it a new day for democracy in Michigan, and she says she is excited to be taking office alongside the new laws.
So I'm ready to make sure we're implementing each of those changes with an eye towards making it easier to vote and harder to cheat, protecting the access of the process and the security of the process.
She says taking the state from worst to first in transparency, ethics, and accountability is another one of her main priorities. Currently, the Center for Public Integrity ranks Michigan last out of all 50 states. Benson says she hopes she'll be able to change Michigan's reputation by doing things like incentivizing lawmakers to willingly disclose their finances.
And I'm optimistic based on my conversations with the legislators, both during lame duck and now as Secretary of State, that we will find a lot of opportunities to collaborate and move forward in concert in a nonpartisan way, in a bipartisan way.
Benson is starting off echoing the governor's message of building bridges and eliminating partisan problems. I'm Abigail Sensky for WKAR News.
The Michigan Department of Education says a controversial new school accountability law will not improve school achievement. WKAR education reporter Kevin Lavery reports.
Republican lawmakers passed the so-called A through F grading law in the waning days of the lame duck legislature. The law would assign letter grades to Michigan schools starting this fall. Educators say that would set back efforts to put less reliance on standardized testing. Interim State Superintendent Sheila Alice says the A through F system would also create two separate accountability standards,
which now causes confusion and discontent. And the schools and districts saying, why once again are you changing our accountability system? Which one is the reliable one? Which one do we turn to?
Alice says the law would also require the Michigan Department of Education to restart a program to help the state's most troubled school districts. The department is asking Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel to review the law to avoid conflicting with existing state and federal statutes. Kevin Lavery, WKAR News.
Lawmakers arrived in Lansing this week for Michigan's 100th legislative session following a turbulent lame duck session. December's lame duck was the busiest in Michigan history, but not necessarily the most controversial. WKAR politics and government reporter Abigail Sinsky is back with more on how last year's session compares to previous lame ducks.
Protesters crowded the steps and rotunda of the State House for several days of December's lame duck session. It was the busiest in Michigan's history, with lawmakers passing nearly 400 bills in a three-week period. Bill Ballinger is a former Republican state representative, senator, and longtime observer of the legislature. He says there's only one lame duck session that last year can really be compared to.
2012 was the most significant lame duck year we've had. This year rivals 2012. Some might say it eclipses.
Some of the most controversial bills that critics alleged would strip power from Democratic Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson and Attorney General Dana Nessel died in the legislature or were vetoed by former Governor Rick Snyder. In the second week of the session, the Protect Our Families rally drew hundreds of protesters from all over the state. Kathy Murphy is a retired school teacher from Kalamazoo, and she says December's lame duck felt like lawmakers were taking away her vote.
The way that they've taken on this whole feeling that is at the national level, too, that they can do whatever they want, and it doesn't matter. Either they're leaving office and they'll get a job with one of their lobbyist companies or whatever, and they don't care what we think. It's pretty obvious.
The biggest controversies coming out of this lame duck session were over bills that amended changes to minimum wage and paid sick leave that had already been adopted by the legislature, and another bill that greenlighted the building of a tunnel for an oil pipeline under the Straits of Mackinac that Governor Snyder had championed but Governor Gretchen Whitmer ran against. Former legislative staffer and political consultant Adrian Hemond worked at the Capitol through several lame duck sessions. He says December's protests don't hold a candle to 2012.
I don't think that those can be fairly compared to the right to work protests. There were a lot more people there for the right to work protest.
In 2012, thousands of people came out to protest the legislative session compared to the hundreds of people that protested at the Capitol in December.
Many of the protesters at the Capitol this December criticized lame duck sessions as a way to jam legislation through quickly without much time for public comment, legislative review, or oversight. They point to Right to Work and the Emergency Manager Law, both pieces of legislation passed following the 2012 session, as examples. Governor Whitmer was state Senate minority leader back in 2012 when she opposed that legislation. She made a speech against the laws being passed in the lame duck session then.
We began this two-year session attacking Michigan workers and their families with their emergency manager legislation. And now for one of their final pieces of business in the legislative calendar, they want to pass Right to Work legislation.
Both Ballinger and Hemond agreed those are the two pieces of lame duck legislation that have had the most impact on the state of Michigan. But now the tide has turned in Michigan politics. Governor Whitmer was inaugurated on the first of the year. And while there's a Republican majority in the state house, all of Michigan's top statewide executive offices are held by Democrats. Hemond doesn't think the bitterness of December's contentious lame duck session will carry over into the new 100th session for lawmakers or protesters.
There'll be some residual bad feeling, but frankly, the environment in Michigan and in the country right now is so absolutely bitterly partisan that I don't know that most folks who don't watch the legislature regularly are really going to notice any difference from the outside looking in.
This year, nearly a third of the 148 state legislators are new, and many of the lawmakers who proposed some of the most controversial bills were term limited. One of this session's first bills was backed by Republican House Speaker Lee Chatfield and Democratic Attorney General Dana Nessel. For now, in Michigan, it's a new year, new state legislature. I'm Abigail Sensky, WKAR News.
You're listening to Current State from WKAR. Conductor Christian Massalaro speaks with WKAR's Jamie Paisley about his upcoming tour performance in the National Symphony of Romania at the Wharton Center in East Lansing.
This Sunday night, a group of musicians will take the stage at the Wharton Center. They are known as the National Symphony of Romania, and according to Christian Massalaro, the group's conductor this weekend, they began about a decade ago thanks to a shared experience in a youth orchestra, one similar to the famed El Sistema method, which has become a model for childhood music education the world over.
A lot of the original founders of this youth orchestra, who are now in their 30s, I would say, or late 20s, early 30s, they have been trying to find ways to continue playing together because there was the bond that was formed. Now, what's emerged from all that is this National Symphony Orchestra of Romania, which is it's a great, wonderful group because all of them have jobs in major orchestras all around Europe, you know, and they get together for these beautiful projects, and this is one of them.
One piece the National Symphony of Romania will play is standard for them, the first Romanian Rhapsody by George Enescu.
The concert is really, from our point of view, is also celebrating not just this incredible orchestra, but it's also celebrating the tradition, the great tradition of classical music in Romania. And 100 years ago, when Enescu was alive, all music and all great art was coming from France. The French influence was so strong.
This French influence is why Massalaro chose to end the concert with Maurice Ravel's famous Bolero.
But then, in the later part of the 20th century, because also politically speaking, Romania was so much under the Soviet influence, there was a huge, heavy makeup of the Russian school.
Which is why Massalaro is bringing cellist Andrei Ionita, a Tchaikovsky competition winner, along with the National Symphony of Romania this weekend in East Lansing.
The music, when he performs, it just transcends him to a different place. And I remember the first time I watched him perform, I wasn't conducting. I went to see a concert with him playing the Elgar cello concerto, and I left in tears because it was the most beautiful. I mean, it brought back images of, you know, Jacqueline Duclair playing and you know, like that sort of transformative experience.
Along with Janica playing Tchaikovsky's Rococo variations, conductor Cristian Masolaru's program with the National Symphony of Romania will round out with music from Richard Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier.
Now, I think in the 21st century, everyone from Romania is certainly looking to the Germanic-speaking countries, where I would say the focus of great classical music remains, you know, which is in Germany and in this sort of central European part of the world. So in some ways I'm representing, or I was trying to represent the you know, distant past, the recent past, and the future of who we are.
Cristian Masolaru leads the National Symphony of Romania this Sunday evening at 6:30 in the Wharton Center. Tickets and more information at whartoncenter.com. In East Lansing, Jamie Paisley, WKAR News.
Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. Have you ever wanted to see inside a TV studio or learn about WKAR's nationally distributed show, Curious Crew? Well, your chance is just a few Saturdays away, and joining us now is Julie Soche, Content and Community Engagement Manager for WKAR Public Media. Hello, Julie.
Hello, Reginald.
So tell us about PBS Kids Day.
Well, PBS Kids Day at WKAR is a fun event with games, activities, live experiments, and helpful resources for parents. Plus, we'll have a visit from a very special PBS Kids guest, Super Y. We will also celebrate the 5th birthday of our original program, Curious Crew.
So if someone is new to our area or maybe doesn't have children, what is Curious Crew? What is that show? Where is it seen?
Well, Curious Crew is a children's STEM program that's produced right here at WKAR-TV in East Lansing. This program focuses on a group of kids, our crew, who take a hands-on approach to investigating principles of science, technology, engineering, and math. They're led by our amazing host and educator, Emmy Award winner, Dr. Rob Stevenson. It's a fun and educational program that entertains and engages. You can see it right here on WKAR-TV and on stations across the state and across the United States.
That's great. Local kids seen all over the country learning about science and math and inviting other kids to learn, too.
Yes, and the unique thing about the show is it's very fun, engaging, and hands-on, and uses experiments that you can do at home with materials that you'll find around your house or around your classroom.
And people will be able to interact and do that sort of thing when they come to our studio as well?
Absolutely. Curious Crew will have an entire setup with multiple investigations that attendees can play around with, experiment with, and learn from. And then in addition, Dr. Rob Stevenson will hold live experiments from Studio A on the stage that everybody can participate in. So a very hands-on, fun, and engaging way to explore science.
We are speaking with Julie Soche, Content and Community Engagement Manager for WKAR Public Media. What else will people be able to see on PBS Kids Day?
Well, in addition to our Curious Crew presentations, we also have Super Y. He'll be here to meet attendees and take photos. In addition, there'll be lots of other fun activities with various community partners, a quiet room for those who need it, and we will have a separate celebration for the 5th season of Curious Crew. With those live presentations from Dr. Rob Stevenson, there's going to be something fun for everybody. And everything takes place right here inside WKAR-TV studios at Michigan State University.
Is there a cost? Do people need to register somewhere?
There is no cost. It's free to attend, and there is no pre-registration required. We just want families to come out to WKAR, show up, and spend time with their families and have fun with our community partners and celebrate PBS Kids.
Sounds great. PBS Kids Day is January 26th, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. here at WKAR Studios on the campus of MSU. We have information on WKAR.org. Just look for the PBS Kids character, Super Y. Julie Soche, Content and Community Engagement Manager for WKAR Public Media, thank you for joining us on Current State.
Thanks for having me, Reg.
Up next, MSU football makes coaching changes, but some Spartan fans are still not impressed. We'll talk with current sports host Al Martin. Plus, young people in the Capital Region share their opinions of the R. Kelly documentary. You're listening to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. A lot of Michigan State sports news happening this weekend, and we're going to start with the death of Gus Ganakis. Current sports host Al Martin is here. Tell me about a little bit about his life and his impact.
Yeah, well, Gus is a household name when it comes to Michigan State basketball, Reg, and really was one of the foundational guys that established MSU basketball as a national powerhouse and destination for recruits and young men who had great talent. And, you know, I got a chance to speak to Gus over the years, and he was always, first off, you know, he had undeniable passion for the game. Always very nice, very down to earth. He was a part of the Michigan State men's basketball radio broadcast alongside Will Tiemann for many years, and he really enjoyed, you know, doing that. And of course, he was naturally close with Tom Izzo, you know, the current legendary head coach of Michigan State men's basketball. So, but you know, 92 years old, lived a great life. And real quick, Reg, a quick statement here from head coach Tom Izzo when the news broke. Quote, "Spartan basketball has lost a dear friend today. Gus was one of the most selfless and positive people that I've ever been around. Our thoughts and prayers are with the entire Ganakis family as they grieve their loss." And just like Tom Izzo just noted, Reg, he was so positive, so upbeat. When you saw Gus Ganakis, you know, he was just kind of one of those guys that you felt like you've known all your life, really.
I'm going to quickly change to another sport, Michigan State University football. Many Spartan fans unhappy that MSU lost the Red Box Bowl to the Oregon Ducks. Coach Mark D'Antonio announced Thursday that Brad Salem will be the new offensive coordinator. Why the changes, Al?
You know, anytime your offense is ranked 116th out of 129 FBS schools, change has to happen. And frankly, if Coach D didn't do anything, again, we have to question his leadership. Giving coaches the axe, that's not what Coach D'Antonio does. He is very loyal. He rides or dies with his guys. And this was just so Coach D, because we all know that Dave Warner, he just doesn't have a great grasp on play calling as an offensive coordinator. So you look at these last 3 years, I mean, two of the last 3 years have been failures. So you have to make a change. All right, well, let's look at the current staff I have. Brad Salem does have play calling experience as a head coach at a D2 college in South Dakota. And we won't know how good of a move or how bad of a move this is until we look at what happens in the 2019 college football year. But the leash for Brad Salem, I'll just say this, the leash for Brad Salem, the fact that Coach D didn't bring in a new voice, the leash is very, very tight. He's only got 1 year. That's a lot of pressure for a first-year offensive coordinator, Reg. So only time will tell, but a lot of folks are just a bit puzzled. You know, a lot of Spartan fans are a bit puzzled because it would have been nice to see a new voice come in, a fresh pair of eyes come in and try and figure this offense out.
Well, we got a bit of good news for the MSU Spartans.
Yeah, certainly. Lorenzo White, the great Lorenzo White, who holds the record for rushing yards, rushing touchdowns, rushing attempts. The most decorated running back in Michigan State football history, Reg. News broke this week that Lorenzo White will be a part of the 2019 College Football Hall of Fame class. So, got a chance to have Lorenzo White on the show on Current Sports on Friday and had a great conversation. It's always great talking with Lorenzo because he's so just chill and laid back and down to earth. And he told a real cool story about how he got the news. And, you know, MSU Athletics had reached out to him, hey, can we get your address? So he does, and he's like, why do you guys need my address? And they're basically like, well, I think you'll be getting something pretty cool in the mail very soon.
When I got to my front door, I seen this box sitting on the step. It didn't say anything, not where it was from, and it had my name on it. So I opened it, and it said, welcome to one of the elite group of, you know, of guys. And it went on to say, congratulations to the 2019 College Hall of Fame.
So it's been a whirlwind for him, and the induction ceremony will take place in New York later on this year in December. So he's amped.
What is the memory that you connect with Lorenzo White?
Oh, for me, I think, Reg, it's when they won the Rose Bowl back in 88. You know, that was the year, you know, James Moore is a dear friend of the show, and James always brings up that year and what it was like blocking for Lorenzo White. But for me, it probably is that year because that time was just so special.
Thank you, Al.
There's a lot going on, isn't it, Reg? Thank you so much for having me, man.
You're listening to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Singer, producer, and songwriter R. Kelly is one of the best-selling R&B artists, but a new docuseries from Lifetime called Surviving R. Kelly alleges he had a sinister side. It features stories of women who say Kelly abused them, isolated them, and had sex with them as underage girls. NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans watched the series and talked with executive producer Dream Hampton.
Dream Hampton first interviewed Robert Sylvester Kelly back in 2000 for Vibe magazine. She knew the star faced controversy over his rumored marriage to protege and singer Aaliyah, who was only 15 when they wed. But she had no idea even darker allegations about his behavior would emerge.
What began to become clear a few months after my story was published was that this was predatory behavior, that he had settled several lawsuits with teenagers. I missed it. I totally missed it.
Now Hampton gets another crack at the story. Surviving R. Kelly features interviews with more than 50 people. They include Kelly's ex-wife, two brothers, and former employees. A number of women allege the singer developed a sexual relationship with them when they were underage and or physically abused them. R. Kelly has denied such charges in the past and didn't respond to repeated inquiries from the program's producers. Geronda Pace, who says she was involved with Kelly at age 16, describes physical abuse which made her decide to leave him.
The breaking point for me was when Rob slapped me and he choked me until I blacked out.
Kitty Jones was an adult when she says she began dating Kelly in 2011. She notes the singer had a way of indoctrinating women.
He calls it training you. You definitely had to ask to go to the restroom, stand up when he walks in the room. You had to ask for your food.
Andrea Kelly was married to the singer for more than a decade. She says his controlling attitude and constant cheating pushed her to consider suicide. Dream Hampton says she centered the docuseries on the voices of these women and many others, average black and brown women too easily ignored by the wider world.
I thought that they were really brave, and I knew that R. Kelly had been doing this for decades, and that if we had 12 or 20 women who were willing to come on camera, there were hundreds more who weren't.
Surviving R. Kelly details decades of disturbing allegations. The infamous leaked video, which allegedly showed the singer having sex and committing degrading acts with a 14-year-old girl in the early 2000s. And recent allegations from parents who say their adult daughters have been isolated by Kelly in something resembling a sex cult. Kelly denies all of it. I'm Eric Deggans.
We wanted to know what people in the Capital Region thought about the controversy. Joining me now is WKAR intern Tatiana Hemphill from Michigan State University. Tatiana, you talked with some students at MSU. What did they think of R. Kelly?
Well, the younger generation isn't shocked due to the history of Aaliyah and R. Kelly's past. R. Kelly's I Believe I Can Fly came out in 1996, which the millennial generation grew up listening to. I spoke with students Stanley and Henrika and Michaela McCann, who watched the documentary, and they were familiar with his music, but also the allegations that were reported in the Lifetime docuseries Surviving R. Kelly.
The documentary made me feel kind of sick because it was it wasn't really a shock. I've known that R. Kelly was a very troubled person for years now. It definitely made me sick to see even more detail into how perverted he is.
Everybody should have been known about R. Kelly. I've stopped listening to a lot of his stuff way before the documentary came out because I knew about a lot of it, especially since I loved Aaliyah a lot. So I just did background on R. Kelly, and it just didn't seem right to me. So.
And for people who may not remember, Aaliyah was the Detroit-raised R&B singer who started her career in her teens but died tragically in a plane crash in 2001. She was 14 years old when she met R. Kelly, who produced some of her first hits. Vibe magazine uncovered a secret illegal marriage certificate between Aaliyah and R. Kelly, which was annulled by her parents. R. Kelly contends they were never married. Tatiana, has this documentary benefited R. Kelly in a way?
Well, Billboard.com shows that since January 2nd of this year, downloads of R. Kelly's music streams are up by 116%, going from 1.9 million on January 2nd to 4.3 million streams on January 5th after the third day of the docuseries.
That was WKAR intern Tatiana Hemphill. She is a student here at Michigan State University reporting on the docuseries Surviving R. Kelly and the controversy surrounding the R&B singer. Thank you for joining us, Tatiana.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us for Current State. The WKAR News team features Abigail Sinsky, Kevin Lavery, Al Martin, Laura Michaels, Jamie Paisley, Scott Pohl, Shayna Roth, and Carell Vega. WKAR station manager is Peter Worf. Susie Elkins is WKAR's Director of Broadcasting. WKAR is part of the College of Communication Arts and Sciences at Michigan State University. I'm Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. Thank you for joining us. For the entire WKAR News team, have a great weekend. We'll connect with you again next time.